Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we'll have the latest on Hurricanes Irma and Jose, including updates on disaster relief for the survivors. In local news, we'll tell you about a revote set for Tuesday night in La Mesa on a controversial apartment project proposal after the developer threatened to sue the city. After the county declared an emergency due to a hepatitis A outbreak, the disease has now reached El Cajon. We'll tell you about steps to protect our communities and new guidelines for the hepatitis A vaccine. Hear about prototypes for the border wall to be built in Otay Mesa. And then from Public News Service, learn about some anti-labor and anti-consumer policies promulgated by the Trump administration, as well as cuts in food inspectors that may threaten public safety. Locally, we have a food safety alert after worms were discovered in salmon sold at Costco. And it turns out that's not the only place this is happening. On the second half of our show, our newsmaker interview is with Ray Lutz from Citizens Oversight, talking about the watchdog group's landmark settlement with Southern California Edison over the nuclear waste at San Onofre. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with an update on Hurricane Irma. Measuring 400 miles wide with winds up to 120 miles an hour, Hurricane Irma slammed into Florida over the weekend as a Category 4 hurricane. The storm began as a powerful Category 5 hurricane, first devastating islands across the Caribbean with winds up to 185 miles an hour, killing at least 39 people on the Caribbean islands. Irma has now weakened to a tropical storm, but is still capable of deadly impacts and near hurricane force winds. It has veered north and is forecast to bring heavy rainfall of up to 20 inches, high winds, and storm surges to Georgia. Parts of Alabama, Tennessee, North and South Carolina will also be impacted, the National Weather Service predicts. On the heels of Irma is Hurricane Jose, now a Category 3 hurricane in the Caribbean that could strike areas already deluged by Irma. In Florida, high winds have knocked out power to nearly 3 million homes and businesses statewide. The hurricane sucked water out of harbors and sent storm surges up to 15 feet high rushing through populous areas, causing flooded streets and swaying skyscrapers in Miami and left some communities largely underwater. The storm has also spawned tornadoes. Twisters adding to the havoc as power lines and trees toppled, roofs were ripped from structures, and boats tossed ashore. President Donald Trump has issued an emergency declaration for Puerto Rico as well as Florida. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, announced that the assistance can include grants for temporary housing and home repairs, low-cost loans to cover uninsured property losses, and other programs to help people and business owners recover from the effects of this disaster. If you wish to donate to help survivors of Hurricane Irma, GlobalGiving.org is an established international organization working with local partners that it has vetted in the areas hard hit by Hurricane Irma. You can make a donation at GlobalGiving.org. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Gene Carpenter with a Capitol Report. President Donald Trump has signed into law H.R. 601 to provide $15 billion in emergency appropriations for disaster response. The measure also extends authorization of the National Flood Insurance Program through December 8th to help those impacted by disasters including Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. The president confounded Republicans in Congress by crossing the aisle to work with Democratic leaders to pass the disaster relief bill, which also extends the nation's debt ceiling until December 8th. Conservatives have opposed raising the debt ceiling, wanting to take money from other programs instead of and or avoid further debt ceiling important decisions closer to next year's elections. In the end, some Republicans joined with nearly all Democrats to pass the bill. In his signing statement, President Trump said he appreciates Congress putting aside partisan policies and acting quickly to ensure the first responders, local officials, and federal emergency management personnel have the resources they need to respond to the natural disasters impacting our nation, adding that, as the damage from Hurricane Irma unfolds, it is especially important that the men and women in the Southeast and our Caribbean territories stand strong and rest assured that this administration will always put the needs of the American people above partisan politics as usual. The Trump administration has ordered an aircraft carrier to Florida, where it stands ready to provide emergency medical aid and other relief in the wake of Hurricane Irma, one of the most powerful storms ever recorded. The president has drawn praise for his swift action in response to the devastating storms, though critics say his failure to acknowledge climate change and his appointment of climate change deniers to head up the Environmental Protection Agency and NASA, which includes the National Weather Service, is blocking efforts to reverse climate change. Scientific experts have warned that warm ocean surface temperatures caused by climate change and the recent hottest years on record are fueling larger and more dangerous storms, such as the unprecedented number of severe hurricanes currently ravaging parts of the U.S., as well as islands across the Caribbean and Mexico's eastern coast. Far more aid will ultimately be needed to address needs of survivors of the hurricanes, as well as wildfires ravaging western states. The governor of Texas has estimated that damage in his state alone could reach $180 billion. The $15.25 billion approved is an important first step, however, to provide rescue and relief personnel during and immediately after these disasters.
This is Miriam Raftery with a local government report from La Mesa. The hotly disputed Silvergate apartment development proposed at the site of the former Little Flower Haven Convent is back up for a vote this Tuesday in La Mesa. The revote comes after a lawyer for the developer sent a letter threatening to sue the city, costing taxpayers considerable money unless the council ratifies a recommendation for approval made by the city's design review board. The council deadlocked 2-2 previously in front of a chamber packed with nearby residents opposed to a parking variance that would allow Silvergate to provide just 193 parking spaces instead of the 260 normally required. The developer contends that the measure should be approved because it fulfilled requirements of a state density bonus. That state law allows a waiver from parking requirements in exchange for a developer devoting 10% of units to affordable housing. But neighbors contend there is already not enough parking in this older community with single-car garages. Many residents have voiced frustration, saying the state law does not take into account the impact of parking waivers on surrounding neighborhoods. Also up for discussion is a proposal to eliminate the design review board, which recommended approval of this project on a 3-2 vote. Now, if the design review commission is eliminated, its duties would be shifted to the city's planning commission. The Design Review Commission is comprised of 2 city staff and 3 outside professionals. The 2 La Mesa city staff members on the board both voted for this controversial development. The Silvergate development would provide $20,000 in permit and impact fees per unit. Some have voiced concerns over potential conflicts of interest with staffers on the commission, although that's not illegal. Another commissioner formerly did architectural work for Silvergate on a separate project. But some La Mesa residents want to keep the Design Review Commission, voicing concerns over eliminating what they view as an important extra layer of review for development projects that this commission provides.
The county has declared a hepatitis A emergency after an outbreak locally has killed 15 people and hospitalized hundreds more. 70% of those cases are in homeless people or illicit drug users. Since El Cajon also has a high homeless population, East County contacted the city of El Cajon to ask if the hepatitis outbreak has spread to the East County community. Councilman Gary Kendrick has advised us the county has identified that some of these cases cases have been within the city of El Cajon. The two most effective ways to prevent spread of hepatitis A are vaccines and improved sanitation. The county is working to vaccinate high-risk populations such as homeless individuals and drug users, and is also recommending vaccines for food handlers, healthcare workers, social workers, and others in contact with high-risk individuals. At a meeting between El Cajon city staff and county officials on August 29th, the county requested to put one or more hand-washing stations in El Cajon. Several possible locations were discussed. The county will pay for a station at a parking lot east of Prescott Promenade downtown and may also add a station on county property near the library. The county has also ordered hand-washing stations in the city of San Diego, which the county has criticized for failing to provide proper sanitation for its large homeless population. Now the county has hired a contractor to power wash streets in the city of San Diego to help stop spread of the disease. The outbreak shows that providing help for homeless people is not only a humanitarian issue, but also a public health concern. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
This is John Fistier with a health report. The County of San Diego has issued new guidelines for hepatitis A vaccines amid an outbreak that has claimed 14 lives and hospitalized 264 people locally. A total of 352 cases have been reported in the current outbreak. About 70% of the hepatitis cases locally have been among people who are homeless, use illegal drugs, or both. The other 30% of cases are among people who don't fall into those categories. The county has been increasing efforts to vaccinate these target populations, as well as those who come into contact with them. Now the county's public health officer has issued recommendations that people who handle food get a vaccination for hepatitis A. County Public Health Officer Dr. Wilma Wooten says, "This is a proactive recommendation because the ongoing outbreak means that the risk to the general public is higher than normal. A person who becomes infected with hepatitis A may spread the disease to others before experiencing symptoms. In an occupation such as handling food, workers may expose more members of the public than workers in other occupations," Dr. Wooten adds. "No common sources of food, beverage, or drugs have been identified that have contributed to this outbreak, although the investigation is continuing. Food handlers can get the vaccination from their occupational healthcare provider, or a local pharmacy that carries the vaccine. A prescription is not needed to get the vaccination. The vaccine is also available to uninsured or underinsured individuals for no cost at all county public health centers. For a list of locations, you can call 211. The vaccine recommendation has also been expanded to those who work in healthcare, in addition to prior recommendations for those who work in public safety, sanitation, homeless shelters, and behavioral and homeless service providers. County health workers are working to increase outreach to educate people at risk of getting hepatitis A. Homeless service providers, treatment providers, faith-based community organizations, and the Regional Task Force on Homeless are all helping notify high-risk individuals about the outbreak. Hospital emergency rooms, community health clinics, and county jails are all helping to administer vaccines. Food teams are also getting out into the streets to offer vaccinations to homeless people. Hepatitis A can cause jaundice or yellowing of the skin and eyes, as well as fever, fatigue, appetite loss, nausea, and digestive tract symptoms. In severe cases, liver failure and death may occur. In addition to the vaccine, hepatitis A can also be prevented through good hygiene. County officials recommend that you never share food, drinks, or smoking materials with other people. Don't directly touch a door handle when exiting a public restroom. Always wash your hands for at least 20 seconds with soap and running water after using the restroom and before eating. 20 seconds is about the length of time it takes to sing Happy Birthday twice.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Homeland Security has announced the four companies chosen to build prototypes of a border wall in the Otay Mesa area in San Diego that the Trump administration claims is needed to increase border security. None of the companies are from California. The prototypes will each be approximately 30 feet high and made of concrete. Each prototype aims to prevent climbing, penetrating through the wall, or digging tunnels underneath it. Border Patrol agents are slated to determine which barriers are most effective at deterring undocumented immigrants and drug smugglers from crossing the border. President Donald Trump has drawn criticism for proposing to cut billions of dollars from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, while spending $1.6 billion this year for the wall's prototypes and potentially up to $70 billion to build the entire wall. Critics say funds are more urgently needed to help survivors of Hurricane Harvey, the worst natural disaster in U.S. history, and potentially Hurricane Irma now barreling toward Florida, as well as wildfire victims in California. Hurricane Harvey alone has caused damages that the governor of Texas estimates could reach $180 billion, much of which is not covered by flood insurance. Michael Seifert with the ACLU in Texas states, "It is disturbing that even during this time of tragedy for Texans, the Department of Homeland Security, which houses both FEMA and CBP, that's Customs and Border Patrol, has chosen to allocate resources for a border wall when the agency's focus should be assisting those who are affected by this natural disaster. Now is the time for this country to come together to protect all people," he says, adding, "Instead, this administration has chosen politics over people." Alliance San Diego Human Rights Director Christian Ramirez, who is also director of the Southern Border Communities Coalition, says building a border wall will come at the expense of upgrading our outdated ports of entry needed to facilitate trade and commerce locally while protecting sensitive environmental areas and human rights. He adds, "The administration's misguided insistence that a border wall must be built is an affront to the just demands of border communities to revitalize and not militarize our region." The Center for Biological Diversity has raised objections on environmental grounds, noting that the Trump administration has pushed forward on the wall without any environmental review, waiving all requirements normally required for any major project. A press release from CBD calls the prototype's effort a reckless project that endangers critical wildlife habitat, hurts communities, and ignores public input. The center filed a lawsuit in June challenging the San Diego prototypes and 14-mile replacement border wall projects, saying the Trump administration is ignoring federal laws that require environmental review and public input before building on public land. Earlier this year, Congressman Duncan Hunter said he was pleased that the prototype plans were moving forward. Hunter, long an advocate of the border wall, added that San Diego should be the model for any added infrastructure on the border. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
Just a few days before Labor Day, the Trump administration has announced two policies that consumer advocates say hurt the average worker and favor Wall Street and big business. The Labor Department announced it is delaying by 18 months enforcement of key parts of the Obama-era fiduciary rule, which requires financial advisors to put clients' interests above their own when recommending investments. Ed Merswinski with U.S. PIRG says the president is simply carrying water for Wall Street.
They've been taking an estimated $17 billion a year out of retirement savers' pockets by giving advice that rewards them with higher fees and commissions instead of rewards you with the best plan.
A study by the Economic Policy Institute estimates that California retirement savers would lose out on $1.2 billion of returns over the next 30 years as the result of bad advice given during the 18-month delay in the fiduciary rule. The Trump administration says the rule places an unnecessary burden on financial advisors and makes them less willing to take on small-dollar investors. Meanwhile, Trump on Tuesday moved against an Obama-era equal pay measure that was supposed to go into effect tomorrow. The Office of Management and Budget announced it will not require companies to report data on how much various classes of workers are compensated. Heidi Scherholz with the Economic Policy Institute says this shows that the president is not concerned with the enduring wage gap for women and minorities.
One of the key things that has contributed to unequal pay is just a lack of transparency. People not actually knowing what people in their group are paid relative to other groups.
Statistics show that women still only make 80 cents on the dollar compared with white men, and it's even worse for single moms and women of color. Business groups applauded the move, saying the reporting requirement would create unnecessary red tape. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A veterinarians group is warning American consumers that the food supply could be in danger because of a growing shortage of federal meat and poultry inspectors. Currently, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has hundreds of job openings for veterinarians who serve as inspectors in the country's slaughterhouses and may not have enough money in the next budget to fill those positions. Michael Gilsdorf, former USDA inspector and former CEO of the National Association of Federal Veterinarians, says the agency's overall vacancy rate is 12%, but is much higher in some regions.
It's a chronic problem, but it's worse right now. They've had a problem for the last 5 years with a shortage, but it's never been this bad. In fact, it was last month when we were told that it was three of the different districts had over a 20% vacancy rate.
Veterinarians with the USDA's Food Safety Inspection Service inspect beef, pork, and poultry products at slaughterhouses and processing centers for potentially deadly pathogens such as E. coli, salmonella, and listeria. Gilsdorf says the shortage puts the public health as well as the economic health of the meat processing industry at risk. Gilsdorf believes the Trump administration's failure to fill key management positions at the inspection service is part of why there are too few veterinarians to inspect the food supply.
They've got I would call it an artificial personnel ceiling because of the budget, and so they can only hire so many people, and they've already reached their limit, even though they have this huge vacancy.
Gilsdorf also says the USDA is at a competitive disadvantage in hiring because of low salaries and the lack of specialty pay for veterinarians.
Basically, they're not competitive in the veterinary market, and only about 3% or less of the veterinarians that graduate are interested in public practice. Most of them are interested in going into small animal, companion animal medicine.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports a significant increase in foodborne illnesses between 2011 and 2016. Gilsdorf says he hopes Congress will approve an increase in next year's budget to bring the inspection service up to full staff. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
This is John Fister with a health alert. Live worms have been found in packages of salmon sold at multiple Costco stores in San Diego County, 10 News reports. The story does not name the type of worm. However, CNN reports that Japanese tapeworms are now being found in wild Alaskan salmon and could be in salmon caught anywhere along the Pacific coast. Other types of fish can also carry tapeworms or different parasites, so health experts advise eating only frozen or thoroughly cooked fish in order to destroy worms and larvae. Consuming raw or undercooked fish containing a tapeworm or other parasite may cause cramping, abdominal upset, and weight loss. In rare cases, tapeworm consumption may result in severe impacts, including intestinal blockage. Medical experts warn consumers that to avoid parasites such as tapeworms, you should not eat raw fish such as sushi, smoked or marinated fish such as that in ceviche. If a patient has a tapeworm infestation, laboratory testing should be done, since tapeworms in humans are treated with specialized antibiotics that are tailored to the specific type of worm infestation. Experts don't advise avoiding all fish, since fish provide lean protein alternatives to red meats, and salmon is high in omega fatty acids that are vital for brain health, among other benefits.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is Ray Lutz. Ray is an electrical engineer. Many of you may remember his name when he's previously run for Congress and the State Assembly out here. He is also the founder of CitizensOversight.org, a government watchdog group based right here in East County in El Cajon. Ray has taken on some major opponents through the years, including Blackwater, San Diego Gas and Electric Company, and now Southern California Edison. And today he's here to talk about a landmark settlement reached with Edison over the nuclear wastes at San Onofre. Ray, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much, Miriam, for having me here.
You're welcome. So start by telling our listeners what prompted Citizens Oversight to file the lawsuit over the nuclear waste at San Onofre.
Well, after the emergency shutdown, that was in 2012, this plant went out of commission. And, of course, now we know it was is basically due to bad design by Southern California Edison that the whole thing went out of commission.
Right. I mean, they had radiation leaking.
Yes. At that point, it started three projects. One, to figure out who has to pay for the plant itself. And that was a $3.3 billion bailout. That was a separate whole thing I was involved in. And then the other second project is the decommissioning of the plant to actually work on demolishing the buildings and taking it out. They have a $4.4 billion fund to do that. And third is the nuclear waste, which is now left. They have 3.6 million pounds of nuclear waste that's going to be left on the site. At least that's the current plan.
Now let's explain why this is so dangerous and such a big concern. My understanding is that they're burying this less than 100 feet from the shoreline in an area where there's obviously an active earthquake fault nearby. It's in a tsunami zone. What else? What are some of the other worries
there? Well, it's a really bad spot. I think it's an insane place to put nuclear waste, only 100 feet from the water, only inches over the water line in a salt environment, which will be corrosive. And they have, you know, gotten the permit. So that in October 6th of 2015, the Coastal Commission voted on the permit that to allow this. This was without any really public review or disclosure until about a week before this happened. We didn't know about it. And so we went up there, you know, had our 2 minutes of speaking saying we didn't like it. San Diego County Board of Supervisors had a resolution saying they didn't want it. But then Bill Horn, who was on the, was it Bill Horn? They had a representative on the panel there who then voted for it anyway. This is a body that doesn't even let you plant roses in the coastal zone because they're not a native plant, and yet they'll allow a nuclear waste dump. It doesn't make any sense.
So heaven forbid, if there were to be a leak or worse, something like a terrorist attack or a tsunami or a major earthquake up there, what could the consequences be? What would the worst-case scenario be, Ray?
Well, this is extremely toxic. So the fuel assemblies that are in the canisters, they are very toxic. If you stood next to one after it was cooled for 10 years, you would still die within 3 minutes.
Wow.
So there are 37 of these inside each canister. They're very toxic, and so the canister provides a boundary layer, an enclosure, but then they also have to be put inside an additional overpack, or in this case, it's a hole in this big block of concrete, and the concrete absorbs the radiation that's coming out so that it doesn't actually get too much into the environment.
So if it did get into the environment through some catastrophic event, obviously not everybody's going to be standing next to these things, but for people that live around Southern California, even as far as out here in East County or up in Orange County, how many years are we talking about that the area could be severely contaminated to the point that it could be life-threatening?
Well, it could be very much contaminated if we had a severe event, such as a terrorist attack, then it would, you know, probably make the ocean unswimmable. It would make those homes unlivable. We might have to evacuate. But the reality, though, we have
to realize... And remember, talking, this could be not just a few years. We could be talking hundreds of years.
It doesn't become safe for many thousands of years. So as you see what's happening in Fukushima, Japan, they have many, many thousands of square miles, I guess, around the plant that are evacuated.
Right.
And so no one goes in there anymore. So yeah. We don't want that to happen to Southern California.
Right. At Chernobyl, where we saw children, generations of children being born with just horrific birth defects, all mm-hmm. kinds of really frightening potential things
but,
that can happen.
You know, we have to realize, though, the best thing that happened here is they did shut down the plant. The
yeah.
plant was much, much like a gazillion times more dangerous than the spent fuel that exists after the fact.
Correct.
So that the fact that we're past getting it shut down is wonderful because it reduced the risk substantially to the residents in the area.
And that's great. I know you had a big hand in pushing and advocating for
right,
that as well.
Right, and we got it shut down. They didn't restart. It would have been extremely risky. What they were trying to do is start one of them at 70%. They were rattling themselves apart. So we got past that.
Mm-hmm.
And now what we want them to do is to not put this waste only 100 feet from the water in this insane location. It's very hard to do because you have to have another place to put it. You just can't disappear the waste with a Star Trek phaser.
Yeah, we don't have a national nuclear waste repository at this point.
They haven't really planned for this. The famous five words of the nuclear industry I say is, let's figure it out later, or we'll figure it out later. And they don't. They were supposed to have a place for nuclear waste in 1997. Well, it's 2017. That's 20 years later, and still nothing has happened.
Right.
And they've had a policy of just leaving the waste at the nuclear plants now that's become authorized by the Department of Energy and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, where they say this stuff can be left there for an indefinite period of time.
And how long are those canisters warrantied for?
Well, the warranty is 20 years. You know, they say they can last longer. No one really knows how long they'll last by
so
the ocean.
So basically they were going to make us all guinea pigs.
We're all guinea pigs already because the nuclear industry has not figured out anything. I believe the largest human blunder that we ever got these nuclear plants started.
Yeah. Well, they did start them, and now we have to deal with the waste problem. So enter citizens' oversight. So you filed a lawsuit. Tell us about who you sued, and then we'll talk about what the settlement entails.
Well, we sued the Coastal Commission to block the permit for that, what they call the ISFSI, which is the Independent Spent Fuel Storage Installation, which is a dry cast storage facility.
We're talking 3.6 million pounds of nuclear waste.
Yeah.
This is not a small amount.
Not a small amount. And there's 75 really big canisters that they're going to be planning to put in this new spot. They already have 50 canisters in an earlier horizontal type of installation that was already on site, mostly from the Unit 1 fuel. The Coastal Commission approved this in October 2015. Since we spoke at the meeting against it, then we had the right to enter legal action, and we did, along with Patricia Borschman, a resident in Escondido, which is another plaintiff. And so the goal was to block use of this ISFSI. The reality is that when we got, okay, so we almost got them into court a week before that happened on April 7th, 2017. They agreed to go into settlement negotiations with us. And then we spent the last few months talking about what could be done. So we don't have a really strong hand here because if we just blocked the permit, Southern California Edison would just resubmit it over and over until it was approved by the Coastal Commission. They already approved it once.
Yeah.
So they would likely approve it again after they dotted I's and crossed T's the things that we found that we could object to. And so we realized that if we did not get a settlement done, we still could not, just even if we won the case, it does not force them to never put it in.
Wow.
And
it's
so
really stacked against the consumers.
And an injunction could not work. I said, could we file an injunction? They said, well, you have to submit a $200 million bond.
Oh, gosh.
And so this is the kind of money that Citizens Oversight doesn't have. So our options were to either go through that route and gamble that, first of all, the court would rule in our favor and say they're going to revoke the permit, and then wonder what's going to happen in subsequent rounds. It may have been good to have, you know, to fight it at each round and see what happens. It's hard to know how that might turn out.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, we said, you know, the real positive way to handle this would be to find a place and to get them working on a better place for the fuel, which has been my agenda from the beginning, to move it from this site.
Yeah.
I'm not of the school of thought that it's okay to put them in really good canisters and leave them here.
Yeah.
I want it moved to another place. I believe that talking about moving the fuel, as hard as this discussion might be, is something that we need to do as a nation to try to figure this out and to try to settle this. Now, some people will say, oh, you're encouraging the nuclear industry by doing that. That means it's going to blossom again and we're going to have all these nuclear reactors. Well, if you look at the economics of these plants, nothing can compete with solar right now. Solar is dropping like a rock. Everything else is going up in cost.
Right, and they're finding even in cloudy Seattle that solar can power a building year-round.
And so the future of the economics are that we don't have to worry about re-enabling this industry. It is going to die.
Of course, that's assuming logic enters into it, and we're seeing the Trump administration wanting to bring back coal. And
that's still not going to work.
No.
I mean, the coal, oil, gas, all of these are more expensive, way more expensive than solar. And solar sits here and purrs along for maybe 100 years. Okay. Once you install it, it's not going to need any fuel.
Yeah.
It's going to get cheaper and cheaper as time goes on.
So let's talk about the landmark settlement that you finally hammered out with Edison that was announced August 28th, and what exactly it includes, recognizing that it's not perfect, but you have called this a practical solution that respects safety concerns. Ray, can you go through the main bullet points of what the settlement does?
The main points are that this requires that Edison spend $4 million to hire a set of experts, the top experts in the nation, and prepare a strategic plan and a transportation plan and investigate a number of off-site options for storing the fuel, including the Palo Verde nuclear plant in Arizona is one where it's partially owned by Southern California Edison, already a nuclear site, and the only nuclear plant in the world that is not next to a large body of water.
Now, on that one, after the settlement agreement was announced, I understand they came out and said they don't want to ask the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for permission to accept wastes from California at their plant. They just want to handle their own and not ours.
Well, they said they were making the assumption that they had to relicense. They said they're not going to seek a license to do that. And actually, I don't even think they need much of a license. They just need the NRC to provide somewhat of a variance or, a rider on the license that they have. They have a general license there.
So that's one of several options. What are some of the other places
the
they
other
could go?
Things that look very promising is the eastern New Mexico location, which is called Eddy Lea, E-D-D-Y-L-E-A, which anybody can Google that and see what it's like. It is in between Carlsbad, New Mexico, and a place called Hobbs, New Mexico, and it's right in the middle of those two, and you can draw a circle with an area of 1,000 miles. And there is really nothing in there except grazing and some mining.
Yes, yeah, very remote. I've been through that area myself.
It's next to the WIP plant, which did have some problems, but it's an area where they had the white sands testing area. As I said, it's mining, and the people that live there are used to mining and other things like that. So they're not as disturbed by having something stored there. Plus, it's an economy and a mindset that is looking for this type of opportunity. On the board of the Eddy Lea Alliance are the mayors from the two towns right next to it. So it's not like everyone is objecting.
They've been okay with nuclear waste at
least. They've been okay. And this is the same type of underground facility that they have already put in at San Onofre. So the canisters will be compatible. And I think the underground facility is pretty good. I mean, it's not above ground, so it's a little bit more immune to terrorist attack. It has a two-layer system, so there's an inner canister and then an outer layer that can be sealed up if you want to. They say that they committed to, this is another element of the settlement, mm-hmm. Two big things that we got. By 2020, October, they are going to provide a repair and an inspection and repair program at San Onofre. So if they do use those canisters there, or at the other site, they will be inspecting those and they'll have a means to repair them.
Good.
Now, we don't look in the settlement. There is no statement that they are going to be using this local ISFACI. It does not say that they're not going to. It doesn't say that they're going to. We tried to get in that they weren't going to use it at all, but that was unsuccessful. It is our position that they should not use this local ISFACI any more than absolutely necessary. And there may be some need to use it a little bit. Well, it's already in, but we don't want them going headlong into just putting all the waste there, especially before. We want them to wait until after the strategic plan is done by these experts to figure out where the ultimate destination is, so they can use this thing called load and go, where they take the fuel right out of the fuel pools, put it into a brand new canister, seal it up, and put it on a railroad car without storing it next to the salty air ocean and letting it degrade at all. Then you have the best chance of moving it to another site without any degradation and without any problem.
Okay. Now, the settlement has not been without its critics, as is often the case in any major issue. A couple of them in this case are public watchdogs and Physicians for Social Responsibility. Public watchdogs called the settlement a disappointment for consumers, and some of the objections that these groups have raised are that, number one, it does allow Edison to keep the canisters there until at least 2030, and that there's really no total guarantee that they would ever be moved. There's some outs in there if it's found to be financially just not viable, if no place will accept it. There are some outs. How would you address those concerns, Ray? And another concern is transporting these, because obviously that puts people in other areas at risk should an accident or something occur. Ray, how would you address the critics' concerns here?
Well, I think that this is sort of like nonsense, because the idea here is we're getting Southern California Edison to hire experts to research what to do in the most prudent manner with this nuclear waste. What's wrong with doing that? Even the Physicians for Nuclear Responsibility said that they actually approved the idea of putting it on Camp Pendleton, which is one of the options that we wanted them to review.
We didn't talk about that one, but obviously...
In addition to the Palo Verde site and the Eddie Lee site, and there's the adjoining one in western Texas, in Andrews County, we also, Citizens Oversight, well, that, first of all, they're supposed to, as part of the settlement, they're encouraged to look at all options.
Right.
And the two options, additional options that we want them to actually include in their research is the, some area within Camp Pendleton, which it already is in Camp Pendleton, but we're thinking about maybe 3-4 miles inland from the coast, up on the hills, so that it's away from tsunami risk. It's away from the freeways and away from the ocean.
Yeah, right, which is rising with
and
global
further
warming.
From the fault line, which is of concern. And, you know, it's on a military base, so it can be protected. So it kind of has some, the good thing about that option is that the fuel doesn't have to be moved very far.
Yeah, and so it's better from a terrorist attack concern
or
standpoint.
Or any kind of accident. I mean, it, and also just public outcry that the, you know, the trains are moving through there. So you don't have to move it on a train. You don't have to even use a big transportation cask. You can just use it in a, what they call a transfer cask.
And it's on a military base, so you can protect
it. It's on the base,
that.
So there's no one around. You can very easily protect. There's a lot of good things about it, so we wanted that one included.
Yeah.
Let me just cover one other option we wanted covered, which was on the rail line somewhere between San Onofre and Yucca Mountain. Some people said all the way at Yucca Mountain. We want it up there. And that kind of makes sense, because the area around Yucca Mountain is the atomic test range, and it's been totally ruined by nuclear bomb tests. And so if you had to pick a place that you would put this, you don't want to ruin some new place.
No.
You want to go to a place that's already ruined.
Really, it's been Harry Reid in the Senate who's largely fought against that, because that would be his district.
True. And so, you know, that's why none of these places are slam dunks. So we just said, look, we want somewhere along, like maybe not all the way in that area, maybe still in California, but going toward Yucca Mountain. And therefore, you don't have to have another state objecting to it. You're putting it in your own state. There's a lot of areas as I go out there, if on the way to you know, Las Vegas, you look down these valleys and they're deserted. So there's got to be some place that's good for it like that.
Desert seems to make sense from a wildfire standpoint. I wonder at Camp Pendleton, has anybody assessed whether wildfires could pose a risk? Because they do have frequent ones actually on the base up there. If it's buried deep enough, is that safe?
I don't really think a wildfire would hurt it at all. I mean, it's not, it's inside concrete, inside canisters. I think even if you just burned it right there, you'd have to have an explosion happen. I think more of a concern on the military base would be like an errant, ordnance that, you know, they would be experimenting with, or somebody driving a tank, you know, in the wrong way or something there. That's Navy land right now. The nuclear plant is leased from the Navy. So, it is on Navy land now. Mm-hmm. And so if the Navy says, well, we don't want it on Navy land, or, hey, well, you've got it on Navy land now. So the idea would be just to move it in. So it makes a lot of sense from that standpoint. And then we wanted them to look at this somewhere along the rail line, just because it makes some logical sense that out in the desert, maybe not too far remote, because you still want people to be able to live near it, be able to get there, have some roads, you know. And there's some very, very remote places. The Yucca Mountain site is not serviced by a rail line now. So it would take a lot of doing to get it all the way up to Yucca Mountain.
Yeah. So the settlement requires basically that Edison has to hire experts. They have to seriously look at the pros and cons of various sites and make a good faith effort to find a suitable place to put this stuff. And they also have to, under the settlement, allow some oversight. And I believe that includes some oversight and reporting back to your group, Ray, citizensoversight.org, again, for those who've just tuned in.
Right. So we'll be getting monthly reports for the first 6 months, and then after that, quarterly reports, because most of the action will be happening in the first 6 months as these experts are selected and they start to do their work. I think that as time goes on, even though there's some pushback on the settlement now, because it admittedly, it does not do a lot of things that we, you know, hoped it would, such as stop them from moving the waste and come up with a place right away to move it to.
Right.
But it doesn't do that because, you know, we don't have a place yet to do that, but we have to go through those steps. Citizens Oversight, our point of view is that the fuel should remain in the fuel pools, which are safe. They are underwater and relatively safe. I mean, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission does not value the canisters over the fuel pools. They're considered just as safe, each one.
Interesting.
And so, these fuel pools are not, they're way less experimental. They've been used for years and years. People know how to use them. The fuel has cooled substantially. It's been there for at least 5 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And so the risk at the fuel pools is much, much less. People compare sometimes the fuel pools at Fukushima. It's not a good comparison because those fuel pools are 3 to 5 stories up in the air in these buildings. These are at ground level. They're just like a swimming pool in the ground.
Interesting.
Lined with stainless steel. If there was an earthquake, would they actually open up and release all the water? Hard to say if that would ever happen. But if it would did, even because they're so much cooled now, maybe nothing would happen because they're cool enough. Hard to say. But we think that within the next 5 years, say, before they get maybe this plan done and another site done, just leave it in the pools and then move it directly there. So the settlement, in essence, sets up this machine to start running to figure out what to do with the spent fuel, not so much to take care of it right now. And most of the pushback that we've had from people against this is because they thought, oh, the settlement will solve everything instantly. And that's not the way it's going to work out. It's going to take some time.
Yeah. So we all hope, of course, that Edison will do the right thing and find a place that's safer than San Onofre to store this nuclear waste over the long term. If they don't, and they come back and they say, gee, Ray, we're sorry, but it's just going to be too expensive. Nobody would take it. We're just going to leave it here after all is said and done. Does Citizens Oversight have any recourse at that point to try to enforce the terms of this settlement?
Well, the settlement itself is enforceable by the court. So we do have that. We do have a few commitments that they've made that they're going to have inspection and repair by 2020, October. And those are commitments that if they say, well, we failed to do that, then we can take them back to court and get something in return from them failing to do it. If they say, which is possible, look, we can't move this anywhere and it's got to stay here, it is still reviewable by the court. We cannot sue them again over this. Mm-hmm. So we are out of ammunition ourselves. We believe that this is the best shot we have to get it out of there.
But you could go in. There's a term that was in the legal agreement.
The basic term that they have is called commercial reasonableness. So they have to operate in a commercially reasonable way. In an agreement like this, you can't, you know, get blood out of a turnip. They're only going to agree to so much in the settlement because it has to be somewhat in their favor. And admittedly, there's a lot of, you know, loopholes in the agreement where they can get out of it one way or another.
But if they come in and say it's not commercially reasonable, you could potentially bring in other experts who would say, well, yes, it is commercially reasonable.
Yeah, we could have that debate
reasonable.
In court to find out if we could have the debate. And I've been told, the attorneys have told me that the commercial reasonableness criteria is a fairly strong one compared to other criteria. The point, though, is that if they say we can't do it, it's too expensive, whatever, then we could take them back to court and see what we can do to get it done. I believe that this is kind of like the first thing in the nation where we've gone this extra step and said, look, we want it moved out of here.
Yeah, it's really historic.
This is going to force everybody to start talking seriously about the issue. They've been avoiding it all this time. Think about it. This whole industry has been decades and decades saying, we'll figure it out later. Look, the gig is up.
Yeah.
It's time to figure this out now.
Yeah, the whole nuclear industry came about, you know, they were touting this as clean power because
right.
It doesn't pollute the air. You don't see these plumes of
right.
know, of toxic smoke produced by oil or coal-fired plants. And yet there was this mounting body of highly radioactive waste that could contaminate a region for, you know, thousands, maybe millions of years, and they never came up with a solution to where to put it. So I think you're to be applauded, Ray, for at least taking that step and making all of the nuclear companies everywhere realize that it's not enough to just say we're going to build the plant and figure out what to do with the waste later on, that in fact, you know, you do have to address that issue.
Yeah.
And come up with a viable long-term solution for it.
It's much harder than they thought. They thought that this waste problem would just be, okay, we're just going to put it in a deep geologic repository. Let's go find one. Well, they came up with Yucca Mountain. It's really not that deep. But the problem here is that these canisters that they're coming up with are far too hot to put underground like that. If they did, they'd have to have big fans on top of Yucca Mountain cooling it for 200 years.
Wow.
It doesn't make any sense.
And there's water intrusion deep down.
There's all kinds of problems with Yucca Mountain. I'm not advocating for it, but
right.
A lot of people in Congress, they've got this Yucca Mountain on the brain, and it has to be, Darrell Issa says, it's got to be approved with Yucca Mountain or nothing.
Yeah, I've heard Duncan Hunter say the same thing.
So they have this Yucca Mountain on the brain. Harry Reid said, no, we're not going to just leave it where it is. Well, what that did was actually stopped all the discussion because this transportation problem was becoming so thorny. Had they opened the Yucca Mountain, I think it would have done more damage to the nuclear industry than it would benefit it. But we're past that now. Solar is so inexpensive. There's no way that these nuclear plants, even though they're building some now, they're not going to really operate these plants. They're completely uneconomic from beginning, and solar is getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. So we are going into the age now of solar and wind and renewable energy. And now, though, we're going to have to deal with this failing nuclear industry and dealing with this waste problem. We got 70,000 tons of this waste around the country. 70,000 tons.
Wow.
Of waste. And right here, 3.6 million pounds. Okay, it's around 3,800 fuel assemblies. It's a lot. So each one of these plants, apparently, the plan so far as the default plan is that they're going to leave it right next to the plant. Some of these plants, and San Onofre is not alone, even though it's kind of a worst case, they're usually by a big body of water. They're usually next to big populations. A lot of places, this is not a good place to put it.
Yeah.
So we need to move some of the waste in certain places away from those areas and put it in a better place. Maybe not all the way to some, you know, perfect place, but just away and reduce some of the risks. Yeah, kind of like the idea of moving in Camp Pendleton, you know, would be like moving in just a little ways.
Yeah,
so it might be a good balance.
With climate change, we're looking at rising seas. We're looking at worse and worse storms. As we're taping this, we've got Hurricane Irma, you know, the worst hurricane ever measured. We just saw Hurricane Harvey. We've got wildfires ravaging the West. So it would seem to me that a lot of places that might have seemed perfectly safe, you know, 20 or 30 years ago when they built these things, maybe aren't so safe over the long haul. So they really need to rethink anything near coasts, anything in high hurricane risk areas, or, of course, earthquake and tsunami zones.
Well, seismic risk is something they didn't even know about when they started building these plants. It wasn't until 1964, the big 9.2 magnitude earthquake in Alaska, when they finally came up with the plate tectonic theory, which underpins all of seismic, theory right now and predictions.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is based on plate tectonics. Well, before 1964, they didn't even have that theory. And we've only had so much time to measure and experience earthquakes. The big one, which is happening at the San Andreas Fault, we don't really know how bad that's going to be because we had no instruments 150 years ago.
Well, there's a Rose Canyon fault out there in La Jolla, which is not all that far away.
That may shift when we get this next big one that comes on the San Andreas, which is 10 years overdue.
Mm-hmm.
So it is an area where all of California should not have any nuclear plants or nuclear fuel stored in it because we are entirely a very seismic active area.
Ray, if people want to find out more about the work you're doing there at Citizens Oversight, or they want to get involved or support your nonprofit efforts here to stand up for the rights of citizens against companies like Southern California Edison, where can they get more information?
That'd be at citizensoversight.org. People can go to citizensoversight.org/signup if they'd like to sign up to volunteer and get on our mailing list. citizensoversight.org/donate if they'd like to throw in some help for what we're doing, because we don't get, a big judgment off of these cases. In fact, we don't get anything at all. The attorneys make their money, but they're not allowed by law to split it with us.
Wow.
Some people say, oh, you must have been rolling in money now that you've got the settlement done. No, we did this for the public, and the way we fund ourselves is through these donations.
Well, it sounds like a very worthy cause there. Ray, I'm going to give you the last word today. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know about the settlement agreement, the nuclear industry, or the work you're doing there at Citizens Oversight?
Well, the nuclear industry is the worst human blunder in history. I mean, this is going to be haunting us for many thousands of years. This waste that we have now is not easy to clean up. It's not easy to deal with. But we're going to have to address the problem. So I ask those people to sort of come with us, you know, get behind the idea of moving it from the site. And the more real we make that, the more real we say, yes, it's moving, the more then Southern California Edison actually has to do it. And the rest of the legislature, Congress, anything that needs to rule on this will then have to get behind it unless they're going to be just an embarrassment. So we need to get behind that, get everybody along singing the same tune, and get the waste moved. We have a lot of other projects. I'd like to go into those, but I just want to stay centered on this nuclear waste issue here because it's of such importance to Southern California that we get this problem solved.
Listeners, if you've just tuned in, we've been speaking with Ray Lutz, who is the founder of Citizens Oversight, the government watchdog group that's just negotiated a landmark settlement with Southern California Edison over the nuclear waste from San Onofre. Ray, I want to thank you very much for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you very much for having me.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.